The old adage, money can't buy happiness, is complicated as researchers try to put an optimal salary amount on personal fulfillment. The average American household pulls in about $65,000 a year. Turns out that we'll need more than that to find that sweet spot. We're talking about it on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is here. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin, welcome back.
Hello, Kate.
And if you have a personal finance question that you want to run by Kevin, you can call it in 800-642-1234. Send it by email to ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, Kevin, we all would like to make more money for lots of different reasons, but a recently published study found that higher earnings don't necessarily mean happier earners. What's that about?
Andrew Jeb, who apparently is a PhD candidate at Purdue University, published a study in a journal entitled The Nature of Human Behavior. And what he did is he and his team took data from the Gallup World Poll that covered 1.7 million adults in 164 countries, and they measured these respondents' emotional well-being and overall satisfaction relative to their stated income.
So what were the results of the study?
There was an earnings threshold for happiness that throughout the study, the constant figure was $60,000 to $75,000 of annual gross income for emotional well-being and satiation at $95,000, meaning they found that overall satisfaction in life wasn't much higher for people who earned more than $95,000 per year on average. And in many cases, they found a correlation between people who were earning more money but reporting lower satisfaction than the people who earned at that $95,000 level. Now, it did depend on the geography. Australia and New Zealanders report a figure of $125,000 that was the threshold. In Latin America and the Caribbean, it was only $35,000. And in North America, the figure was $105,000, after which people generally did not report higher levels of emotional well-being and overall satisfaction with their lives.
So what makes up for this big difference between the regions?
It's two factors. One, obviously, is the cost of living in each one of these areas. If you live in an area that's more expensive, the good news is you probably make more money than you would if you lived in a less expensive area. The bad news is it costs more. And so in Green Bay, Wisconsin, you can live a very nice life on $50,000 a year of gross income. In Manhattan, you probably need about $150,000 to $200,000 to have the same type of life, depending on your situation. But also, it's a comparison to others, and we've seen this in several studies before. We tend to look around at the people we work with and the people we live by, and that's what we compare ourselves to. And if we work with people who make more money than us or have a higher professional status than us, or if we go home and we live around a lot of people who have bigger, nicer houses than us, and especially within, it's usually a radius of about 1 mile to our home, those are the people who determine how we tend to feel about ourselves and how we're doing, and then it affects our self-evaluation of how we're doing as well.
Then how can we apply these results to our own situations, our own lives?
Well, for big picture things, and especially for younger adults who are deciding where they want to live, this is good advice, is try to live in the lowest cost area that you can possibly stand. That might mean a city or a state or even just a neighborhood, and still earn enough to support your lifestyle. And then when you are looking around, this is one of the reasons that charity work is so fulfilling to a lot of people. It's not just about doing good. That's obviously important. But it's also about, you're probably working with people who are less fortunate than you are or have been unable to achieve some of the things that you've been able to achieve. And when you're around those people, it tends to help you become more grateful for what you have and what you've become, rather than feeling like, oh gosh, I don't have, you know, a lake home and a huge car and my kids aren't paying cash for college and I feel terrible because I know some other person who's doing this. And I think, quite frankly, social media exacerbates this. We've also seen several studies where people who spend a lot of time on Facebook or younger people who spend time on Snapchat tend to feel worse about themselves afterwards. And it's because everyone is presenting this life that may or may not be real, but they're presenting the best version of themselves. And that's obviously not the truth. And so when we see that, we either inherently or explicitly filter that back to our own lives, and we don't feel as good about ourselves. And then also, when you're trying to decide about doing things for the money, whether you're going to go back to grad school to earn a degree that might give you a job, or you're going to take a promotion that would be more responsibility but more money, or even the difference between working full-time versus part-time or being a stay-at-home parent, you're going to have less time and less flexibility. You're going to pay more taxes, and you're going to pay other costs on top of that as well. So think very carefully about things before you decide to do something just for more money.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. You can join in the conversation if you have a question, a personal finance question for Kevin. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can send it by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Dale now, joining us from Muskego. Hi, Dale.
Good morning. My question is this. I recently took out a HELOC on my home, and I took it as an interest only, and my first bill is due. And my question is, do I pay more than what the interest is due, or do I just pay the interest and put that extra into a savings account?
Yeah, Dale, I'm glad you brought that up. And the reason being is there was a change in the tax laws at the end of last year. We've discussed it several times in the past. We will in the future as well. One of the big changes that might affect a lot of homeowners is that interest on home equity lines of credit and home equity loans is no longer tax deductible, unless in some cases where you use the money for home improvement. And so that, for people who are in an average tax bracket, that can add 20% to the cost of the interest, meaning if you were paying, let's say, 5% interest on the home equity line of credit, it now technically costs you the same as a 6% home equity line of credit loan would if you would have taken it out last year or would have been paying the interest last year. So it's more expensive now than it was before. Dale, do you have, let's just say, 3 months' worth of living expenses set aside above and beyond this home equity line of credit?
Yes.
Okay. And are you working, or are you retired or not working?
Retired.
Okay. You know, if you have a lot of money set aside and you really have no other obligations, I think it's fine to pay it off. It does save you some interest, obviously. And then as long as you don't close it out, a lot of times people think the responsible thing to do is once they pay off a home equity line of credit is to close it out and cancel the thing. And I don't think that's a good idea. Even if the lending institution is going to charge you some money to keep it open, some banks or credit unions might charge like $50 or even $100 a year to keep it open. But for many of us, our home is a significant portion of our overall net worth. And it's a very illiquid asset, meaning to try to generate cash from the home, it's very difficult to do unless you sell it or borrow against it. So keeping that home equity line of credit open, but paying it off as you can, is obviously going to save you money. But whatever you do, Dale, don't cancel it out even after you pay it off.
Dale, thanks so much for the call. Kevin, here's a question from a listener who says, you are so smart, funny, and handsome. So they've covered all their bases.
Aw, Mom. Good. Thank you.
My daughter recently discovered her daughter defaulted on a student loan in 2013, which my daughter had co-signed. Now, when daughter wants to buy a house, this default is on her credit report and her income cannot be used to buy a house. How can she clear her credit report of this defaulted loan?
If you co-sign a loan, it's an easy thing to do in terms of just signing a piece of paper. And then the person who otherwise probably would not be able to get the loan and usually is a family member, often an adult child, can get the loan. Seems really easy to do, but it's just like you borrowed the money when you co-signed for the loan. And if the borrower doesn't pay it back, it's just like you defaulted on the loan yourself. And in theory, the lenders can take you to court, and the lack of payment on the loan will definitely affect your credit rating as this woman's daughter is finding out.
So what should the cosigner do in that situation?
Talk to the original borrower. It sounds like it's the granddaughter in this case, and see, is there any way you can start paying this back, even a few hundred dollars a month, even just to get current on the payments so there is some cycle for it that shows that it is going to be paid off. It will still affect the credit rating of both borrowers, the original borrower and the cosigner, for a while, for several months even, but at least it will show that there is some progress in getting the loan paid back, and eventually it might help the original cosigner in her ability to get that new mortgage.
But what if the borrower can't make the payments?
Then the cosigner is going to have to shoulder the responsibility. She should go back and talk to the original lender and see what can be done. Explain the situation and say, I co-signed on this loan. Obviously, my daughter isn't paying it back, and it's obviously affecting my credit rating. What can I do to get current on this, or even to pay the thing off if it's possible? One of the things that the cosigner might do is she might want to talk to her current lender and see, is there a way that she can roll in the money owed on the defaulted loan into this new mortgage? Sometimes, depending on the situation and depending on the value of the home and the borrower's circumstances, it might be possible for the lender to say, okay, we were going to lend you, let's say, $150,000 for this new mortgage, but we see that there's an $18,000 loan, let's say, that's been defaulted on. We'll now make the loan $168,000 so that you can use some of the proceeds from this to pay off that old loan as well. And that then should give you the credit score you need to get this loan in the first place and hopefully get it off everybody's credit report.
You are with us for On Your Money, and our Sage financial advisor, Kevin McKinley, is here. You can join in with your personal finance question at 800-642-1234. You can send it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in just a moment for more On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for On Your Money, talking about pressing money questions and a deadline drawing near for some people with IRAs. We'll be learning more about what April 1st has in store in this edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in with a personal finance question that's on your mind at 800-642-1234. Send it by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to Sarah now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment about a previous caller with the defaulted loan. If it is a student loan, there's actually a couple more options. They could actually rehabilitate the loan, which would be to make 9 consecutive payments, and you would have to agree to it with the loan servicer, but it actually would remove the defaulted credit from your credit report.
Sarah, thanks for that. Kevin, what do you make of that?
Well, Sarah, are you still on the line?
Yes.
Okay, great. Do you work in this field?
Yeah.
Okay, great. This is really helpful, and I'll tell you, we have so many people, as you know. You know, you might go home and say, gosh, is the entire world struggling with their student loan payments right now? And we get way more calls as a percentage of questions than we do for other things, especially from young adults. And it is something that they're very concerned about. Sarah, can you back me up on this, and forgive my ignorance on this, but for people who are struggling with student loans, and again, I think there's the figure something like now is 1 of 10 students who have borrowed money to go to college are actually in default already, and several are a much greater percentage are higher percentage are behind on their payments. One of the things that I recommend to people is that they call the lender as soon as they run into trouble, and they're embarrassed to do that, but that's really their first easiest step to trying to figure out, is that true or would you disagree with that?
The first thing I would do is actually to go to the National Student Loan Database System. It's a free government system, which basically lists all your student loans. And then it has, because some of your loans could actually be sold to different servicers.
Right.
So there could be a couple of loans that are, some are at Fed Loan and a couple other of the department servicers. So you would have to call each individual servicer, and you're absolutely right, and they are very willing to work with you because they want to get paid as well. So, that's how the basically you have to ask. If you are defaulted, you would have to ask for a rehabilitation on your loan. And what that means is they agree to a payment, and a lot of time it's based on your income. So it could be, I've seen the rehabs as low as $5 a month. Then it's basically, like I said, based on your income, and you would have to make these consecutive payments, and they have to be perfectly 30 days apart because it's showing that you have a commitment to this loan. And then at that point, at 9 months, they basically put your loan back into repayment, which means you could qualify for deferments again. It could be income-based repayment plans, all of the government repayment plans you qualify for again. And then it also clears the credits for you and also for your cosigner.
Great. And was this true for both private loans and the federal loans?
This is a federal benefit.
Okay.
Some private loans will work with you, but this is a specific federal.
Great. Sarah, you've done your good deed for the day and tens of thousands of student borrowers. Thank you. So I appreciate you calling in.
Yeah, so much precision and timing there as well that we might not be taking into consideration. Thanks, Sarah. Let's go to Sue in Mequon. Hi, Sue. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for this excellent, excellent financial program, Kevin. My question has to do with charitable giving. And since the new tax laws, my interpretation of this is that I don't need to keep these acknowledgement letters, like if I give $100 or $1,000 to someplace, unless I give huge amount of money, which we're probably charitable donors in the maybe $5,000 to $10,000 range max.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason to keep any paperwork?
Right. Did you use the donation as a deduction? Did you deduct it?
In the past, we have.
Okay.
But I don't see that going forward it makes any sense.
Probably not. And because if you don't use the, and by the way, you are very generous donors. The average dollar amount given by American households for donations is somewhere around $2,000, and usually those figures actually include money donated to religious organizations that might be tithing or might be, giving money in church on Sunday or something. So that's a very generous dollar amount. Good for you. But in terms of deducting it, you're right. The new standard deduction is $12,000 for a single filer and $24,000 for married couples filing jointly. And most people find even when they add up all of their deductible items, including charitable donations, the standard deduction will be higher than that entire deduction figure. Therefore, they won't deduct their charitable costs or their charitable donations, rather. So, no, you don't have to keep the receipts in this particular instance if you're not deducting any of your donations.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, Sue, thank you for calling in. And let's go to Bob now, joining us from Franklin. Hi, Bob.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. For 2017, I invested $6,500 into a spousal IRA. This year, I turn 65. If I start collecting Social Security, can I still invest in a spousal IRA?
Well, is it a spousal IRA for yourself, Bob, or is it a spousal IRA for your spouse?
It's for me.
For you. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not working. She is.
She is. Okay. Yeah, you can definitely, if you meet the qualifications and you collect Social Security and you have a spouse who has earnings on which to base the spousal IRA contribution, absolutely. You can still make a spousal IRA contribution even if you are collecting Social Security.
Oh, wow. That's nice.
Yeah, in fact, you should because Social Security can be taxable when you receive it. And if you can reduce your taxable income by making that spousal IRA contribution, you reduce the likelihood and then the taxation on those Social Security payments. So if you got the money to do it, please do.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for the call. Jeff now in Appleton, you're up. Jeff, go ahead.
Hi. I'm trying to maximize the FAFSA. The FAFSA grants that my daughters can get. What are the guidelines for that, or how do they formulate that?
Yeah, for people who aren't familiar, the FAFSA is the free application for federal student aid that I think anyone who is going to some form of higher education should fill out. It's at FAFSA. That's Frank Allen, Frank Sam Allen, FAFSA.ed.gov. And you should fill it out as soon after October 1st of, if you have a student in high school, that person's senior year in high school. So October 1st is when you can start filling it out. But you can fill it out any time after that as well for the subsequent year. And it's really the source of any financial aid, especially at public schools. It can be just grants, it can be student loans, it can be work study, but you have to generally fill out the FAFSA first before you can qualify for any kind of that kind of need-based financial aid, and in some cases even merit-based aid. Jeff, how old are your daughters?
I have one who's a third year in college, and the other is a junior in high school. So my older daughter, she's been getting Pell Grants. But, you know, my stock portfolio is growing, and I just, you know, I want to make sure that my younger daughter also gets the same type of grant.
Yeah, it's...
I've been maxing out my Roth IRA, and I know that, you know, they don't count your home equity, but is there any other place? You know, I just worry that if my individual stocks grow too much, then my daughter won't qualify for the financial aid.
Right. That's a good problem to have. It means your wealth has increased in one place so that your need has hopefully decreased for it. And usually if it's an asset in your retirement accounts, it doesn't count as all in the expected family contribution. That's what the FAFSA generates. It's called the EFC. And they say, hey, based on your situation and then based on the school in which you're planning on attending, here is what the family has to come up with, the EFC, before any need-based aid is going to be awarded. And usually, retirement accounts do not count at all, parental retirement accounts. And parental assets, let's say you own a mutual fund that's done very well in the last few years, at the most, that might count about 5% in the expected family contribution. So even if you have $100,000 in that mutual fund, Jeff, the EFC will probably only ask you to add at most about $5,000 into the formula before they award any need-based aid. And you know, quite frankly, it's need-based aid, and if you have the means to pay for it to some extent, they are only asking for 5% of your money. I'm willing to bet if it's a normal stock fund, I might have made even 5% in the last 6 months or so. And so that money is going to be asked for before any grants or need-based loans are awarded to you. So there's not much you can do to it other than watch out for realizing capital gains or selling any of these assets in the years in which you are applying for financial aid, because that can be that can show up as a higher income, and that may disqualify you for more need-based aid than you'd otherwise get. But in some cases, you can go to the financial aid office and say, hey, I know I generated a capital gain of, let's say, $20,000 in this year we're talking about, but that's a one-time deal, and therefore, can you not include that in it? And sometimes the financial aid office is willing to do that.
Jeff, thanks so much for the call. You're with us for On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in with a personal finance question that's on your mind at 800-642-1234. You can send it by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've been discussing certain money moves that need to be made within the next few weeks. And this week, Kevin says certain IRA owners need to act by April 1st. What gives, Kevin?
No fooling. IRA owners who turn 70 and a half in 2017, last year, they need to take their first required minimum distribution technically by December 31st of last year, of 2017. But for that first required minimum distribution, there's a grace period that lasts until April 1st of 2018. Again, this is only for IRA owners who turn 70 and a half in 2017. However, even if you use this grace period, you still have to take another required minimum distribution from that IRA in 2018 as well. And it's very important, because if you miss any required minimum distribution from a retirement account, whether it's your IRA, an inherited IRA, or anything like that, there can be a 50% excise tax imposed on the required minimum distribution about the RMD. So if you were supposed to take $10,000 out by a certain deadline from an IRA and you did not, and the IRS catches that, they will hit you with a $5,000 penalty on that $10,000, and you still have to take it out and pay taxes. So by the time you pay the taxes on it, you'll probably, that $10,000 with the penalty on the taxes will be down to about $2,000 or maybe $3,000. So pay attention.
So how is the required minimum distribution, the RMD, calculated anyway?
What the IRS requires us to do is to add up all of our retirement accounts, our individual retirement accounts. Your spousal ones are not included in this. So if you're married, it's only your retirement accounts, not your spouse's accounts. And get the balance at the end of the previous year. And then the IRS divisor is taken underneath that. And it starts out at about 27 or so. So if you have $270,000 in your IRA, let's say, and this is your first year of taking the required minimum distribution out, you divide by about 27 to get an RMD of about $10,000 or so. And again, that calculator is available at irs.gov. And then most investment firms and financial services firms have their own calculator online as well that you can use to figure out what you need. So go to Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity or your own financial services provider, and you have to take out at least that amount. You can take out more if you want, and you can pay taxes on that, but you have to take out at least that RMD amount.
Is there any way to avoid having to take the RMD?
Not really. There's something called a qualified contract. You can put some of your IRA in that can kind of kick the can down the road for a few years for your RMDs. And we're going to talk about that in a few weeks. But the provision is still in place. So people who are over 70 and a half who don't itemize, and that number is going to grow quite a bit because, as we mentioned earlier, the standard deduction has grown by so much as of December 31st. A lot of people won't itemize. But those people over 70 and a half can still take their RMD and transfer some or all of it to a qualified charity, and it's tax-free. They don't have to itemize to get the tax break, but they do have to transfer it by the date, and there's no taxes to it as well. So if you don't really need the RMD and you're thinking about donating it to a charity, you can do that and avoid the taxes on the distribution, which can also save you money on taxes on such things as Social Security and capital gains. So it's a good idea to do it if you don't indeed need the money.
So what tips do you have for IRA owners who are under age 70 and a half and want to reduce the RMD amount and the taxes for that matter?
Yeah, if you're thinking ahead and saying, gosh, we're really going to get hit pretty hard on this, but we're only 62 or 63, one thing you can do is convert some of your IRA to a Roth IRA each year, as long as you can stay below what is now the 12%, the top of the 12% federal income tax bracket. And that's a gross income amount of about $50,000 for single filers and $100,000 for married couples filing jointly. So the reason you want to do that is you'll hopefully pay less in taxes on it when you convert it now than you will if you just let it ride and take the required minimum distribution after turning 70 and a half. And remember, the great thing about Roth IRAs is there is no RMD on Roth IRAs as long as you're alive. You don't ever have to take the money out. And even if you do, there's no taxes on withdrawals. And under today's laws, withdrawals of Roth IRA money does not affect taxation on Social Security. And for most middle-income retirees, that's a big deal because a lot of their Social Security can come to them tax-free or taxed at a lower rate, and therefore they can pull money out of the Roth IRA and it won't hurt them in a bit.
You're with us for On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here. Let's go back to the phones now with Ellen in Waupun. Hi, Ellen.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. In a comment toward your basic income, what makes people happy, I always think of a question posed to John D. Rockefeller, which was, how much is enough? And his statement was, a little bit more. For all of us. My question is, I have some basic credit cards from major retailers, and I want to get rid of them. There's no balance on them, and I have rarely used them in the past anyway. But what is the best way to get rid of those?
Yeah, the best way to get rid of those, you mean just the actual piece of plastic?
No, I realize I can just cut them up. But okay. Is that the right thing to do?
Yeah, absolutely. You should definitely just cut them up into little pieces and that can be kind of enjoyable to do, especially if it means you've paid off the credit card. But are you also canceling the accounts, Ellen?
Well, that's what I don't know. Is that something that I need to do?
Yeah, it depends on your situation. If you feel that some people are self-aware enough to know that if they have unused credit balances, they're going to draw from that via credit card purchases on buying things that they don't necessarily need and will regret later on. And so if that's the case, it is probably better to cancel the account out. But if you do that, it will affect your credit score somewhat, not to a great degree, but it might lower your credit score because part of your score is predicated on the amount of available credit you have that's unused. And if you zero out all of your credit cards and then pay the things off and then close the accounts, that reduces the amount of available credit you have, and then it will reduce your credit score somewhat. Now, if you don't plan on borrowing money in the near future, Ellen, that's probably not a big deal. If the credit card company is going to charge you a fee that you just as soon not pay, like $50 or $100 to keep the accounts open, that's another reason to zero it out. Just make sure when you do close those accounts out, if you choose to do that, that you make sure it's noted on your credit report that you closed the account, not the credit card company. Because if you break up with them, it won't affect your credit score. If it looks like the credit card company broke up with you, if you got dumped, that can affect your score as well. And the way to do that is after you close these accounts out, go to annualcreditreport.com about probably 2 to 3 months after you make the decision, annualcreditreport.com, and you can get a free copy of your credit report once per bureau per year, and then look on there, and it'll say something like account closed at customer's request, and just make sure that it says that. If it doesn't, contact the credit card company and say, hey, can you change that so it's noted that I broke up with you, you didn't break up with me.
Ellen, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Rich now in Maple. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. I got two real quick questions. We have an annuity with the Vanguard. Do we have to RMD that?
Is it an IRA annuity, Rich, or just a regular tax-deferred annuity?
Tax-deferred annuity.
No, if it's not an IRA or a Roth IRA for that matter, no, you don't have to take a required minimum distribution on those. Usually it's only the people after you pass away and leave it to your heirs that distributions are required to be taken out.
Okay. And then we did really good in the market, well, for our standards. So we took all our cash out because we thought it was going to turn around, and it hasn't, but it might. So we're both 70 years old. Do you think we should, at our age, should we have some money in the market?
Well, let me ask you this. Have you figured out how much you need to be comfortable in retirement yet?
Yeah, we're doing really well.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that, and congratulations. It's a good point to ask that question, in part because stock market investments, if you will, are generally at all-time highs. We've had a 9-year run in the stock market that's been very good, but it's also created a riskier situation for people who want to be in stocks. And if you don't need the growth, and it doesn't sound like you do, and you don't want the risk, no, I'm perfectly fine with someone saying, you know what, you've probably been through, Rich, 3 or 4 different bear markets, crashes, corrections, whatever have you. And in most of those cases, things snap back pretty quickly. The next time the next crash comes, and it may have started yesterday and it might not start for 3 years, but when it comes, the conditions might not allow things to snap back really quickly. And that's bad enough if you are working and have income coming in. But when you're retired and you're really relying on that savings, that's the time when people ask themselves, why was I in these investments? I didn't need the growth. I didn't want the risk. I won the game, but yet I was getting greedy and trying to get a greater level of return, and I ended up losing 20 or 30% of my money. And as I'm spending it, that exacerbates the loss. It's like the reverse of dollar cost averaging. When you're contributing money to your 401k or your IRA while you're working, it's good to have prices go down because your fixed dollars buy more prices or more shares at slightly lower prices. And it's the reverse when you're pulling out, say, $2,000 a month out of a $500,000 portfolio. If that drops to $250,000, now the percentage you're pulling out of the portfolio is much greater if you still pull the $2,000 out. So it's hard to know without looking at your situation exactly, Rick, but my instinct, based on what you've told me, is that no, don't reach for return that you don't need, and then you'll be avoiding risk that you don't want.
agree. It's just that when you see this market go up 400 points, you kind of kick yourself in the butt and think.
That's right. They call that fear of missing out. It's true, not just in the stock market. It's true life in general. But again, look at your situation. Compare it to the average household. The average retiree, Rich, probably has maybe $150,000 in liquid assets to save right now. And if you have more than that, you're doing much better than average. And if you live in Maple, Wisconsin, is that right?
Yeah, right.
It can have a really nice life on a lot less money in Maple than you can in, you know, Los Angeles or Boca Raton or Manhattan.
We can eat breakfast for $3.
And you are with us for On Your Money. Rich, thanks so much for the call. And Kevin McKinley is here answering your personal finance questions. Phone it in, 800-642-1234. You can email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. When we come back, there are a bunch of ways you can save money when you go to the movies. It might not be a luxury outing like you thought. We'll get tips on how to save. Coming up next here on the Ideas Network. If you go to the movie theater, you could easily shell out more than $50, especially if you load up at the concessions on your way to your seat. We'll get some practical advice on how to save at the movies. On this edition of On Your Money, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here. He's fielding your money questions at 800-642-1234. You can send them his way via email to onyourmoney.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Sherry now in Oshkosh. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I had a couple questions. I just also wanted to say I listen all the time, and this is a wonderful program. You've taught me tons of stuff that I didn't.
Sherry, thank you for that false praise. As a regular listener, you know that's the best way to get your question answered.
I made sure I put that in because you appreciate that, and it is all very true.
Thank you.
So you deserve it. We appreciate your donating all your time like this. I had questions about that fraud alert comparing it to the credit freezing your credit report. Mm-hmm. My financial planner told me that people had so much trouble opening up their frozen accounts or their frozen credit report again after they did that. Do you agree with that? And from when I called Equifax about freezing or doing the fraud alert, mm-hmm. They told me that people trying to open accounts, if somebody was in your name, that the company they were trying to open it with didn't have to check out to be sure that that person really was you.
You mean under a fraud alert?
Yes.
Yeah, that's correct.
If the company wants to, they can call you and verify that you were trying to open up a new account.
Yeah, with the fraud alert, you're relying on the company systems, the provider systems, to say, hey, we think there's something kind of fishy going on here. With a credit freeze, the credit freeze says no one can get into my credit bureau, the report I have at the credit bureau, without my permission. So if you try to open a credit card account, or anybody else does for that matter, you have to unfreeze it, and you have to say, yes, you can look at this information, and then after 48 hours, or let's say, you close it down after they've had a chance to look at it. And your financial advisor or planner, whomever, is right. It is kind of a drag to do it, and especially in light of that Experian and Equifax and TransUnion, all these data breaches that they've had, there's been much more attention on credit freezes. And then people are starting to wonder, why do these people have this information on me? And why do I have to work to try to protect the information that I didn't give to Experian or TransUnion or Equifax. And so there is some legislation coming that may make it easier for us to freeze our credit reports. But in the meantime, Sherry, I would much rather have you go through the effort of freezing your credit report. You only need to open it up if and when you intend to borrow money again in the future. And for most people, that's a pretty rare circumstance. And so it is kind of a drag to do it, but it's not like, going to the dentist or anything like that. It's relatively easy compared to that. And it's the best way to keep your identity from being stolen and having cards charged up in your name, which you won't be responsible for. But sometimes that debt, between the time that it's acknowledged that you didn't charge that up, that debt can be sold to credit collectors, and then it can be sold again and again and again. And you can get calls 5 years later saying, hey, you owe $10,000 to us because we bought that debt you charged up. And you say, well, I didn't charge that up. And they say, yeah, that's what everybody says. We're going to see you in small claims court. And it's very difficult to prove a negative that you weren't the one to do it. And especially if it's a kind of a fly-by-night outfit that just is trying to fish for people who are willing to pay it off. I had one person who said to me, yeah, I've got my identity theft stolen. They charged up on a credit card account. It was, $1,500, I think. And she said, I didn't owe the money, but it was such a drag afterwards to try to keep proving to people that that wasn't me, that I didn't do that. She said, it would have been smarter for me just to pay the $1,500 off and then get it off the bill collectors for the rest of my life. So I'd much rather have you go through the credit fees. We're going to be talking about that in a few weeks, rather than just using the fraud alert.
Sherry, thanks so much for the call.
My mama told me, you better shop around.
It is time to shop around. The Oscars just ended, and the summer blockbuster season is about to begin, if you can believe that. But if you want to see any of these movies in the theater, get ready for ticket sticker shock.
Kate, are you a theater-going family?
Yes, we are. We do like to go, but it is a lot of money to shell out. So it's once in a while, which should be music to your ears.
Yeah, I do appreciate that. The United States, you're not alone in that. In the United States, the number of tickets sold is now at a 27-year low, and the prices, though, may still make you feel old if you were younger and used to go to the movies a lot. Total U.S. revenue is $11 billion, down 2.3%, and admissions is down 6% from the previous year to $1.2 billion. That translates to an average ticket price of about $8.97. That's up 3.7%. And again, that number seems extraordinarily high to spend $9 to go to the movie, and more if you're going in a metropolitan area or paying for some of the premium showings. But it's still below the 1977 figure of $2.23 per ticket average when you adjust it for inflation.
So what can we do to make going to the movies more affordable?
Well, avoid the crowds. And whether you're agoraphobic or not, don't go to the first showings on the Friday night. Don't go to the Prime Theaters. Don't go to the 3Ds and the IMAX showings, etc. If you are going to go, try to go in a weekday afternoon. That's usually when it's less expensive and you get a better seat. And go to the second-run theaters or even the third-run theaters if you really want to see something in the theater experience for it, too. And then finally, and I'm sure you go through this, too, try to eat before you go so that the snack counter doesn't look quite that tempting. and if you do, I've seen this done before where people will buy a large popcorn, and if they have kids, they'll actually split it between the kids and bring a couple paper bags so they can split it up. Popcorn in the movie theaters, that's and sodas to a lesser extent, that's where the theater operators actually make their money. There's an 800% markup on the cost of popcorn, and soda has a 600% markup. So you're doing the theater owner a favor by stopping at the snack counter, but you're also making the experience probably at least twice as expensive as if you were just buying a ticket.
Oh, but that butter, it's worth a million, Kevin.
Are we sure that's butter, Kate?
Oh, yeah.
It is a yellow
it is a substance.
Gooey substance,
yes.
Right?
we'll classify it as substance. Well, it matters, too, where we buy our tickets.
Yeah, if you go online, which my kids actually do this, they go online in advance, especially if they're going to a big showing, and they like to buy the tickets online to make sure they get in, but you're going to pay a convenience fee of $2 to $3 a ticket online. You can go to Costco or Sam's Club if you're a member, and sometimes they sell discounted movie tickets. there. You should also friend the movie theater you like to go to, or the movie chain, or even a website like Fandango, that and you can find out special offers that you'll receive via their email newsletter or Twitter or on Facebook. And then finally, there's a service that's just come out called MoviePass that can really save a lot of money for regular theater goers.
And how does that work?
It's kind of like a Netflix for going to a movie theater. They've been around for about 6 years, but they were just taken over by one of the co-founders of Network, and they've been growing very quickly. They have about 1.5 million subscribers, and they added 500,000 in December alone. And how it works is you pay $9.95 per month, although on their website right now they have a special that it's $7.95 per month if you prepay for a year. And then you can go see one movie per day at participating theaters. There are a few restrictions for it. Not all theaters obviously apply, and several of the premium showings, like the 3D and the IMAX showings, are not available for this as well. But you choose your movie and your time in the theater through the MoviePass app, and then once you arrive at the theater, the app automatically fills a debit card with the ticket fee, which you then buy at the kiosk, and the prices have dropped dramatically so that people who do want to go to movies on a regular basis and have the time to do it can go for the equivalent of pennies a day. Because they're growing so quickly, there have been some customer service issues. MoviePass is trying to ramp up to address these. A lot of times the issue comes with getting the actual MoviePass debit card sent out to people. But if you want more information, go to MoviePass.com. That's MoviePass.com. And we'll have a link to that website, along with all the other websites that we've discussed today, at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
And let's try to squeeze in one more call here. Kathy in Green Bay has been waiting. Kathy, go ahead.
Good morning, Kevin. I just wanted to give you some genuine praise. I'm an enrolled agent with 30 years experience, and I actually tell my clients to reserve 8 o'clock on Tuesday morning.
Well, thank you, Kathy. I really appreciate you imposing your wishes and my and Kate's voices on your clients. But thank you. That's very nice.
Yep, it's wonderful. And I just wanted to address the record keeping. What I tell my clients is to keep the paper. If they need it, they have it. They don't lose tax dollars. If they don't need it, they can start a bonfire in the spring.
That's very good advice. You can slide it in, and in today's record-keeping world, you can digitize it or scan it in pretty quickly as well. So you're right. It's better to have the paper and not need it rather than to need it and not have it.
On those charitable donation records, indeed. Yeah. Kathy, thank you so much for calling in. And Kevin, what is the website of the week?
Yeah, the New York Times, people, you've probably heard of it, but they have a financial tune-up program right now that my friend Ron Lieber, who's a great guy, he's subbed in for me on this show periodically in the past. They put together a really neat financial tune-up program that's very easy. It just asks you a bunch of questions, and it gives you a lot of free advice that you can use to get better financially. It's at nytimes.com/programs/FTU, financial tune-up. But again, we'll have the direct link at that website, at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And how long does this financial tune-up take?
It's just 7 days, and so it's a really easy way to get the information. Just go right online, start clicking. You don't even have to enter any information if you don't want to. But it's one thing the New York Times is doing to try to bring in readers. Their cooking section is also a really great place to get recipes as well, and I really like what they're doing. But again, we'll put the link up at onyourmoney.com.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8, and it's rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. This edition of On Your Money was produced by Michelle Johnson with technical direction from Michael Derringer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.